Carlyle is gentle, reader. I am not. As you follow me to President Ganymede's party and the truths beyond, remember that as your historian, I cannot let kindness restrain me when I choose which doors I open for you and which I close. Chapter the 10th. The Sun Awaits His Rival. I give you the Renunciation Day party of Ganymede Jean-Louis de la Trémouille, Duc de Thouars, Prince de Talmont, President of the Humanists. Versailles was not so gilded, Paris so chic, Hollywood so glamorous, nor Babylon so infamous as the town of La Trémouille since the Duke's return. The French nobility was officially disbanded on June the 23rd, 1790, but nostalgia is more powerful than any law. So, when this young stranger bought up a clump of lots unworthy of the name estate and declared himself to be the Duke returning to his ancestral lands, the locals rejoiced at this opportunity of fame and tourism. The line of Dukes de la Trémouille officially died out some centuries ago. But there are always bastards and lost cousins waiting for a fortuitous conjunction of wealth and DNA testing to reinstate them. The family home had not survived, so the Duke built a fantasy palace, period in style, but too opulent. The gilded woodwork too elaborate, chandeliers too huge, halls too labyrinthine, fields of sculpture and topiary stretching too far beyond what the eye can take. So stunning is the ostentation of the place that Ganymede's fellow humanists have forgiven him for spurning the hive capital of Buenos Aires to remain here in what was, until the Duke's arrival, European turf. Photographs taken at La Trémouille are blurred by too much light, recordings ruined by too many happy voices, but to stand there blinded by a world of unbroken gold is worth the fortune one must spend to get there. It always costs a fortune, reader. For if time is money, then the hours spent gaining influence enough to receive an invitation means that every guest has paid a fortune. Only Ganymede is not drowned out by such a backdrop. No thread of fabric touches the alabaster of his skin that is not silk or finer, and no cut of garment graces his figure that Louis XIV would not have worn. His cuffs drip with lace. His waistcoat swarms with embroidery, a monarch's costume to make Dominic seem the servant that he is. The Duke wears no colors but gold, ivory, or sometimes blue. But even true spun gold seems somehow pale beside his golden mane, which shimmers like the sun around his shoulders. The blue of his eyes is beyond sky blue, beyond sea blue, beyond amethyst, a ferocious blue like the blue of diamonds and star sapphires. The Hope Diamond, the Star of Asia, gems who leave behind a history of murder. Clothed so, he embodies the age when a peasant, glimpsing such beauty through the window of a passing coach, might think that all his toil is worthwhile if the sweat of his back allows so noble a creature to grace the earth. Nude, he is a god. Mycroft, good, walk with me. I want to talk with you. The Duke spoke French with me, the leisurely, satisfied French of one tired of pretending he is not bitter at his hive for preferring Spanish. Yes, Your Grace. The Duke President led me along one of his long galleries, where masterpieces jostled for space on the damask-paneled walls. The party was young yet, a mere few hundred notables chatting in corners, or listening to echoes from the great hall where Ting Ting Foster teased the Royal Belgian String Quartet by constantly segueing from one aria into another, forcing the strings to shift course like children behind a fickle kite. "I spoke with Occam Sanir today," the Duke President began, pretending to scratch his cheek so the lace of his cuff veiled his mouth from lip readers. "Apparently you were at the house during Martin's intrusion." "Yes, Your Grace."
"Was Martin cooperative?"
"Very cooperative, Your Grace. Martin is offering every courtesy and taking every opportunity to avoid establishing any bad precedents."
"But not so with Seneschal."
I struggled to keep my voice soft. "Dominic came to the house?"
The Duke paused to smile at a trio of humanists who had strayed close enough to eavesdrop, but dispersed like startled pigeons at his glance.
How magnanimous of the President, they must have thought, to grant a glimpse of heaven to this lowly servicer.
"Mercifully," he continued, "the only person that bloodhound saw was Leslie Sinéer, but I'm not happy having any of my people exposed to him, especially not the Sinéer Weeksbooth Bash. That's why we're going to settle this ourselves."
"We, Your Grace?"
"I'm lending you my ears and eyes tonight. You will channel my tracker through yours, see and hear what I see and hear. I need you to tell me whether Sniper is behind this."
"Sniper?" The thought, obvious now, had never crossed my mind.
"It's not impossible."
The Duke President nodded.
"I wouldn't put any stunt past Sniper. If this is just the prank of some enterprising mafioso, then Occam and Martin can take care of things. But if Sniper did this, I have to know. I'll give you a nice close look, show you the expression Sniper won't show the cameras, then you'll know."
"You place too much stock in my abilities, Your Grace."
He turned his back, the bright tails of his pleated frock coat almost brushing my knees.
"You know no one listens when you say that, Mycroft. You may rest in the kitchens as you watch. I'll summon you to report when the party's done. You don't have to be absolutely certain, but your best guess will be sufficient. Give me a direction to set my own hounds. I shall do the rest myself."
"Yes, Your Grace. And Mycroft," he called, "if anyone asks, I called you here to look for cheaters in the betting pool. Tell no one you spied for me tonight. Not Ancelet, not Spain, not Ando, not Caesar. No one."
"Your Grace, if a certain person asks, make sure that doesn't happen. We have to bury this, Mycroft."
His eyes flashed their diamond, deadly sparkle. "I don't need to point out that if the public eye turns on that bash, it will mean the end of your comfortable little arrangement with Thisbe Sinéer."
I squeezed my hat, comforting in my hands like a child's doll.
"I know, Your Grace. I'll do my very, very best."
"Good.
Now, off to the kitchens with you. Sniper won't show until I've gathered enough notables in one place to set up a worthy entrance."
I was well installed on my stool beside the ovens by the time the Duke President reached his first targets, whom he had spotted in the Salon de Conquête. There was already a crowd within, but as he entered, President Ganymede pressed a finger to his lips to silence all who spotted him. The lesser guests knew what he must want, and left the Duke a clear path toward Cousin Chair Briar Cosala. She had shed her costume from the Pantheon, and was back in a cousin's wrap, this one less a robe than a chaos of marbled scarves, a dozen shades of green, whose silk-soft chaos made her, if not the most elegant of the present elite, certainly the most comfortable. Censor Vivian Ancelet stood behind her, back to back, still in his purple uniform, the couple trying not to feel awkward among the evocative masterpieces in the aptly named gallery. In stone, in oil, in chalk, the room was crammed with first knights. Antony and Cleopatra, Romeo and Juliet, Achilles and Patroclus, Don Juan with a variety of beauties. Jupiter appeared in his many amorous transformations, the bull carrying off Europa, the swan coiled suggestively between Queen Leda's thighs, and the shower of gold descending to impregnate the ancient princess Danae, locked in her father's tower. These were not innocent nudes,
nor even half innocent, like a classical Aphrodite pretending to cover herself with an ineffective drape. These were all fully sensual, not yet in the actual act of sex, but so intent upon it one could think of little else. Silent as a lion, which is as much a cat as any other, Ganymede prowled in between the silent pair. Reaching gently, he massaged Kosala's shoulder with his right hand, while with his left he stroked the underside of Vivian's palm, as lovers do, inviting one another to hold hands. Neither victim glanced back, but both smiled at the touch of gentle fingers, Chair Kosala arching her back, while the censor grasped the president's fingers, soft as a woman's, and held them warmly. Ganymede pressed his luck, moving closer to Briar until their flesh shared heat, then craned his neck to let his breath reach between the dreadlocks that tickle Vivian's bare ear. Only then did Chair Kosala turn to see why one of her bodyguards was trying so hard not to laugh. She almost screamed, "Ganymede!" She and Vivian gaped at the Duke between them, who smiled, looking as smug as the sculpture behind him of naked Hephaestion, basking in the hungry gaze of Alexander. In fact, since Duke Ganymede himself had been the model for that particular Hephaestion, the likeness was exact. "You see," he lectured, "this is why couples should stand together in this room, not apart." As the pair stood frozen, Ganymede gave each kisses on both cheeks, then pressed them into one another's arms as if arranging dolls. "Like that. See? Better." They held the pose only a moment before balking back. "Ganymede," Chair Kosala began, "we were looking for you." "Then it was mutual. Come, there's something waiting for you on the Ruby Walk." He seized Chair Kosala by the hand, the lace of his cuff mingling with her hanging silks like the leaves and blossoms of wisteria. "Something for your bedroom wall." Pure Indian ancestry has made Briar Kosala's hair as rich and dense a black as any on the planet, almost dense enough to hide behind. "I thought you'd forgotten about that." "Dearest Briar, I never forget anything. Come along, Vivian." He dragged the censer by his gray law sash. "Briar's not going to use this piece alone." Ganymede swept out of the salon with the speechless couple helplessly in tow. The long main gallery they entered now had a sleek, reflective red carpet, which preserved the tracks of humanist boots, no two alike, whose custom soles stamped the receiving fibers with the sigils of many athletes, actors, thinkers, and tricksters who played the celebrity game well enough to walk Ganymede's halls. The boot design is nearly 200 years old, created when the Olympian hive, which lived for sport, merged with World Stage, which lived for concert and spotlight, to form the humanists. A hive united by the passion to excel, achieve, improve, and constantly surpass the past limits of human perfection. I believe there has never been, nor shall be again, a government as stable as the humanists. Rome grew mighty under kings, then stifled as they became tyrants, forcing the bloody revolution which birthed the republic. When that republic's conquests outgrew the Senate's power to govern, it took a second bloodbath to return to monarchy. How many bloodbaths has France endured? India, China, Florence and Athens, trapped in their constitutions, unable to switch to monarchy when crisis demanded one voice. The humanists alone have escaped this cycle, trusting voters to choose not only governors but governments. Humanist elections have no short list of candidates. All may vote for anyone they please, and everyone who receives even a thousandth part of the voting pool receives in turn that portion of the power. Today, universally beloved Ganymede commands 63% of the vote, and so wields 63% of the powers of government, and adds president to his list of titles. The other 37% of the power is distributed among his rivals, 22, and the title of vice president to the runner-up,